Hey, everybody. You know, Mark and I have over 20 years of experience as therapists and as addicts in long-term successful recovery. We know better than anyone what works and what doesn't to break out of porn and sex addiction, heal betrayal trauma, and reclaim your relationship.
And we've poured all of our personal and professional recovery and healing experience into a first-of-its-kind program for addicts, spouses, and couples. We call it Dare to Connect.
At least four times every week, we engage with you in real time, in the trenches, giving you the knowledge and the tools to take back your life and relationship.
Whatever else you've done on your journey for healing and recovery, you've never done anything like this.
You know, Mark and I, we've made all the mistakes, so you don't have to. Don't reinvent the wheel.
We all know tomorrow never comes. Look, don't wait one more day to change. Claim your free two-week trial today at daretoconnectnow.com.
Hey, everybody. I'm Steve Moore.
And I'm Mark Castleman.
We know the pain and heartbreak of porn and sex addiction.
And we know the triumph of breaking completely free.
Every day, we help our clients find hope and healing.
Join us in the fight to take back your life, your marriage, and be stronger than ever.
This is the PBSC Squared Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Mark and Steve here. We have a really special treat for you today. We're actually doing an interview with Todd. And Todd is an amazing guy who participated in programs that Steve and I had in the past. So he worked with us professionally and comes from a history of addiction like the two of us and has been in solid, awesome, you know, amazing recovery for years. And he agreed to come on today and tell his story and offer some great insights for those of you out there who are maybe not in recovery and trying to decide if you want to be, or you're kind of in it, or not having all the success that you would like. And even wives, spouses out there who are currently challenged with betrayal trauma and a husband who's struggling. We're just excited to have Todd to tell some of those things from his perspective and give a different viewpoint or vantage point than just hearing the two of us week after week. So Todd, welcome. We're really excited to have you, man.
Yeah, thanks for being here. It was great.
Thanks. I'm kind of excited. It's nice to be able to kind of reach out and have that ability to help other people. And I think in return, it just helps me, and, you know, I'll be selfish in this and take the most out of it. And appreciate you guys being able to do this and be able to reach plenty more people to help them out. So it's a great opportunity. So
yeah, awesome. We're super psyched you're here. Well, let's just jump right in and give you an opportunity to share your story and go back to the beginning. You know, when did this thing start? When did it start to become an issue for you as you look back, and what was that like?
Yeah, it's crazy even at my age to still be able to remember the beginning. There's lots of things in my youth, because that's kind of when my addiction started, that I can't remember and have a hard time remembering. But for some odd reason, the first experience that I've had in masturbation can always come to the forefront of my mind when I need it to or want it to or question about it. And, you know, I think with a lot of other people I've dealt with throughout group therapy and come across and been involved in to helping or just kind of been around during recovery and addiction, is I think that kind of resonates that a lot of us at a young age, you know, I was 12, 13-ish when had the first experience with masturbation, kind of as an innocent experience, you know, during that development time. And then from there, it just kind of exponentially grew without kind of me realizing what I was involved in. And, you know, shortly after at that, my age is when internet developed, and that just, you know, was like throwing gasoline on a fire type stuff and kind of as I kept getting older and getting into high school and developing with relationships and dating and all that stuff, it just kind of added way too many more dynamics that just perpetuated more pornography and masturbation and type stuff. And the understanding of addiction at that point, especially with sexual addiction, like it was very easy to deal with chemical addictions at that time, because that was just, oh, you have to avoid a substance. But with sexual addiction, it's exploiting, you know, a natural process within the body, type stuff. So a lot of people didn't have a great understanding at that point and a great understanding of how addictions work. And so when I got caught up in it and my parents found out, I was like, go see the bishop. And the bishop's like, oh, well, don't do that. Or, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll avoid that behavior. But avoiding behavior was more like, I just will try and avoid getting caught again. And thought I had myself kind of good enough to go on a mission, just, you know, for the church. And came home off my mission, had a good mission. Got back into dating, pornography slowly crept back in. And then at that point, it was like I discovered the relationship with my wife and thought, well, having a marriage will be able to have an outward way to actually express, you know, my sexuality in a safe, appropriate way. And so for a few years in marriage, it was good, and was able to avoid pornography because I had that void filled. But then all of a sudden, you know, 3 years into marriage, you know, developing with those dynamics, somehow it slowly creep back in. And then from there, it was just like wildfire. Just because now I actually experienced sex. I was experiencing now pornography and masturbation. And then it just became more dissatisfying and wanted more and more and more. And it became out of control to the point where I led to my first affair. And still at that time, I don't think people had a great understanding of addiction. It was still like, well, don't do it kind of deal. And so when I got caught up in an affair, through coworkers and things like that, and then got discovered that way, it was like, oh, well, you got to do this program and this. And, you know, it was just spending time avoiding behavior, and got a disciplinary counsel through the church that I got disfellowed, went through that process. But still in my mind, it was like, well, if I avoid being caught, then I should be fine. If I avoid letting people know my behavior, then I'll be okay. I can just deal with this and find it. And then for some odd reason, I got back caught up in another affair and another one. I think there was a few other people involved. And then finally that got caught, and that led to not only a disfellowship, an excommunication. And at that point was when, you know, I had to go one way or the other. It's like, I either had to, like, you know, end my marriage, you know, and at that point, you know, I had, you know, years under my belt in the marriage. So it was either end my marriage and just be caught up in addiction my entire life and live on my own and deal with my consequences and avoid other relationships because I kept on ruining them type stuff, or follow the advice and get into a more intense program. You know, and at that time, my stake president thought I needed to do an inpatient program. And that was an interesting concept because it's here's like, I'm going to be inpatient for a while. And for some reason, I got pointed towards your guys' program. I think there was contact within the stake and they knew of it. And so I got directed that way. And still at that time, it was like, well, I just need to avoid the behavior kind of deal. I'll just kind of do what I need to, because in the back of my mind, I didn't want to lose my relationship with my wife. I didn't want to lose my relationship with my kids, kind of deal, type stuff. And so you just kind of, I kind of had to deal with what I needed to do, type stuff in order to kind of save that. And so it was still a reluctant kind of process. And even getting into the program, I was very defiant. And I think even Mark, you pointed out during the program how I kind of went through that process. I didn't want to do any of it. I was just kind of slowly just going through the motions and kind of just doing the bare minimum, which is kind of a bad tendency of mine. You know, kind of do the easiest way possible to kind of get the same results, type stuff. So it was like surface level stuff, and kind of got called on that. And I know Steve kept on nagging me, he's like, well, you need to start reaching out. you need to start doing this. I'm like, oh, well, I did. I sent a text message to a guy. How you doing? Kind of deal. He's like, no, you need to reach out. Like, you need to call type stuff. And slowly started doing that stuff and having those connections with other people and expressing all the stuff that I was dealing with inside internally that was actually really feeding my addiction. All these, you know, turmoil relationship issues that I've been dealing with throughout my entire life that I didn't realize was going on underneath the surface. And it wasn't until I was finally willing to like kind of open that door to other people and letting them see that I started to get into good recovery. And it was one of the very interesting things I know in a therapy session with Steve, kind of breaking down things and kind of understanding my relationship, just even with my parents kind of deal, and realizing that somehow in my mind, even though I had great parents and that they did the best they could, somehow in my mind, I learned that love was always something I had to be earned, that I had to do something in order to earn love. And in the back of my mind, you know, addiction was always something that kept me from earning love. And so that was always, anytime I dealt with the relationship type stuff or my behavior and, you know, expressing what I was involved with was always something that like, well, that's going to take away from earning my love. So why would I want to express that with somebody? And so when I started reaching out with other guys, I was allowed the freedom to kind of express all those relationship issues I was having and know that no matter what I expressed with these gentlemen, I could still have their love because we were brothers in addiction. And it was by that means that led me to having a better relationship with other people, but more importantly, allowing myself to express even those thoughts with my God, to the point where I can have an honest prayer about like all the issues I had with God and with myself and all that stuff. Whereas before, you know, prayers with God was like, you know, you had to follow a certain order. You had to talk to him in a certain way, kind of deal in order and have an appropriate prayer with God. But then it was like, now through reaching out with guys, now I can do a reach out with God, kind of deal. So prayers became a reach out, as opposed to like a prayer. And when I finally was able to break down that relationship with God and finally realized that I don't have to earn love from God, that it's always there no matter what, it made it that much more easier to realize that, hey, whether I'm caught up in addiction or not, God's going to love me no matter what. It took away that notion to want to have that behavior of addiction, of masturbation, pornography as a way to, you know, God's going to love me no matter what. So that kind of fuel towards expressing my addiction went away. It was like, well, I'm loved no matter what, so I don't have to act out in a way in order to seek love, kind of deal. And so, and then fast forward a year later, got, you know, rebaptized in the church, and then it just kind of has gone from there. And so, but having that fundamental relationship that I can always present myself to God no matter what, I think has prevented lots of other behavior. And makes it a lot easier to maintain a recovery type stuff, because the behavior, you know, of sexual addiction no longer appeases itself as much. Triggers are still there. You know, I still get triggered with things type stuff. I still deal with issues, but now it's like I have a better avenue where I, in a better way, that no matter at any time, I can either reach out to God, reach out to my brothers in group and do that stuff. And so, you know, fast forward, I think now we're 3-4 years without, relapse type stuff. I've lost track of kind of time-ish. I think it's just easier for me to do day by day and every day kind of present myself to God and say, hey, this is where I'm at. This is where I like to go. But let me follow you and do what you would like me to do. And so, kind of deal. And so it's been a roller coaster. It's been a blur, type stuff. And, you know, for some odd reason, I have this great wife who's supported me through it, type stuff, who's been amazing, who's been able to see that side of me. You know, it's been tough. It's been tough for me to watch her go through what I put her through. You know, it was definitely fearful, you know, before I got into the program. It was definitely fearful to feel that I was going to be on my own without her. And that was a very scary thought process for me that I think has really helped me to kind of not want to go there again, type stuff. But I think for some unforeseen thing on her side, she's kind of helped through it, type stuff. And what I realized now, it was never about her. It was always about the issues inside that I was outwardly expressing, the issues inside myself that I was outwardly expressing in a behavior that was very inappropriate, that was taking away from really great relationships, type stuff. And so, definitely, when I started getting into recovery, was able to see my wife in a different way, was able to see my kids in a different way. And that was a really unique experience, type stuff. And so to be able to view that, kind of deal. So anyway.
Oh man, so much there. I don't even know where to start with questions. I've got like so many.
Yeah, there's a lot. It's hard to summarize that. And I think that's what's tough. And I think every time someone's asked to tell their story, it's like, where do you go? And so many different ways. And I think, I don't know, each moment in time, you know, you realize or you express different things. And so it's been a while since I've kind of shared my whole story. So that was really good. So anyway.
Well, start with the first question on your mind, Steve.
Gosh, where to begin? I guess maybe I'll try to keep my questions in chronological order. And we really appreciate you, Todd, for being so raw and real here. Yeah. This is scary stuff. Mark and I do this professionally, and obviously, you know, we write books and stuff about it. So I guess we should be comfortable about it with it. And just appreciate you being here and willing to do this. As looking back, you know, there are a lot of variables that I see in my work. And I'm sure Mark sees as well, that tend to leave a guy vulnerable to addiction, right? That tend to kind of contribute early on. Because everybody obviously goes through that phase of kind of sexual curiosity. Some of us get pulled into more destructive, compulsive, and eventually addictive behaviors with regard to that journey, and some that don't. I am curious, as you look back, what do you feel like was one of those factors leading up to that point in your life that left you the most vulnerable to this becoming an addictive issue for you?
For some odd reason, I always developed, and I always felt like I always had to prove myself in every situation. I don't know. I mean, I like to joke and tease that it's, you know, the hierarchy of when you're born plays a factor into it. I was the middle child. I don't need to dwell on that too much and make that an excuse kind of deal, but I don't know. Part of me feels like there was always something I was trying to compensate for, you know, and in high school, it became a popularity contest type stuff. And I got really caught up into that, type stuff. There was also, you know, I've always had, this kind of back unlining kind of shame about my physique, kind of deal that still plays a part to it even today, that I've tried to learn to use as a motivation to help for a better cause than for the behavior of sexual addiction, type stuff. And so I think, you know, addiction being developed in a young early teenage years really exploited a lot of those thought processes, where you're trying to find your place on basically who you are, right? I think that's kind of the underlying question that I think plays in any kind of addiction, whether you talk about sexual addiction or addictions to drugs or alcohol, or, you know, any other kind of process addiction or substance addiction, like the whole question of who am I kind of deal plays a part. And I think even to today, you know, the behaviors I, you know, deal with, whether good or bad, is always kind of that question of who am I. But I think at a young age, like it's a really sensitive thing, and you don't have that big broad perspective understanding as a teenager. And so to have an addiction like pornography and masturbation, you know, come about in that part, even innocently, is really tough to kind of deal. So and like I said, when I developed a kind of thought process of like I have to earn love, right? You know, I have to earn love with the oppression of like having these insecurities dealt with it that really made it hard to overcome. And I didn't realize that going through that. And I didn't realize that up until I got into recovery, that that's what was kind of some of the fuel, some of the biggest fuel for it. So, and it's tough, you know, and I met guys in groups that, you know, I always dealt with being bigger and kind of fatter. And yet I've also dealt with guys that were always skinnier and wanted to be, you know, more muscular, that had that same kind of thought process of, you know, the physique, you know, the physical appearance playing a role into it, type stuff. So, I don't know if that answers the question, but you know.
Yeah, no, I love what you're saying. I was actually talking with a client just the other day about this, and I don't know if this, hopefully this analogy resonates, because it resonated in the session. I think all of us have, like, anyone who's got like puzzles or kids or, you know, games and stuff in the closet, every game, it seems like there's always that one favorite game that's like missing a puzzle piece or missing a card or missing a, you know, the little car in Monopoly or whatever. They're always missing chunks. And when I look at addiction, specifically sexual addiction, which we're talking about today, what I find with guys is that it almost functions like a master puzzle piece. Mm-hmm. Or a master game piece, right? Mm-hmm. For a time, on a temporary basis, it can almost fit or fill any of those voids, be it insecurity, be it not feeling like you're enough, you're not loved or lovable, right? And there's lots of others. And I'm curious how that kind of played out for you. Do you feel like that was part of the deal for you?
Oh yeah, it's a huge part. And as a guy, like society, like I don't think, you know, especially, you know, growing up and throughout, and even still to this time, like you're not really allowed the freedom to out really express that because of, you know, when you define a guy, right? Like, and you're defining who am I, right? I'm a guy. It's like, oh, I'm not allowed to express that stuff, right? Like I have to be tough and things like this. And you try and live up to that expectation and definitely, you know, having, you know, sexual addiction behind the scenes makes it so that you really have a hard time finding all the pieces to your puzzle. And you're scrambling to find those things, but yeah, you always have to present as if your puzzle is complete.
Yeah.
Kind of deal. And so if you can show a little corner or a little, you know, a different, you know, significant section of your puzzle to be like, well, look, it's looking good. It's, you know, I got a good puzzle here. Right. Kind of deal, and hide those missing pieces kind of deal. Or even, a lot of times, you know, you talk about that, like a game piece, when you're missing a piece, you try and find a different piece to put in. It's like, oh, well, this little jelly bean's now a character or whatever. Like, this is the piece we're missing. And then halfway through the game, you're eating the jelly bean. I don't, like, you just find replacements for that to present as if you have a full puzzle, kind of deal, is what you're supposed to do as a guy, right? You're supposed to present that you have it all together and you're tough and you can handle anything, kind of deal.
Totally.
And that was also when I was at kind of the crossroads, the fork in my road, where I had to either go recovery or be on my own, and on my own kind of deal, it was like, well, I can just deal with whatever. I've already dealt with whatever my entire life, kind of deal with addiction. You know, I can present whatever I need to present, be whoever I need to be for whatever situation. It's like, if I need to be the great husband, I'll be the great husband. If I need to be the, you know, the guy that was caught up in an affair, I'll be the guy caught up in an affair, you know, kind of deal. And I can transition back and forth, and it, you almost feel kind of bipolar at times, kind of deal, because you can go back and forth and you can make whatever piece be whatever you need to be in that circumstance, kind of deal. And so that definitely played a huge role in keeping that addiction hidden for so long. So,
yeah, I love what you said about how it causes a lack of coping too, because you're right. I mean, and we talked about this once on the podcast before, where, you know, the addiction itself is progressive in so many ways, but one of them is, I call it kind of that Peter Pan syndrome, right? Where in many respects, we don't grow up, in part, at least for a time, we don't really have to, because we've got this, again, magic puzzle piece, right? Mm-hmm. Feeling inadequate or down, porn is right there to make you feel like you're totally adequate and up, right?
Yeah,
Feeling like nobody loves you. Well, here, I've got people on the screen who will do anything to physically love me, right? Yeah. Quote unquote, love me. But then obviously it's never sustainable, right? I love your jelly bean analogy, because you're right. It is just that. It is the jelly bean. However well it may work for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, it always ends up being consumed.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah. Well, and Todd, you said something about this having to earn love, mm-hmm. right? I have to do certain things to be acceptable. I have to, you know, meet these requirements to have worth or to be yeah. valued. And yeah. it sounds like you evolved to the place where you realized that God's love for you was unconditional, that he unconditionally yeah. not only loved you, but he unconditionally accepted you.
Yeah.
And that's a huge thing. I mean, can yeah. you say a little bit about how you made that transition?
Yeah. And it's really scary to kind of realize that we live in a very reward-based society where everything is earned, right? Everything that is of good or value that we have is earned. And how much of those relationships we have with other people that we feel we have to earn things. And then we perpetuate that onto our God. And I did that for years and didn't realize that type stuff until someone really pointed out, AKA Steve pointed that out, kind of deal. I still remember those words, kind of deal. He says, like, he's like, it looks to me as if someone you somehow you learn that love is earned and to perpetuate that on to a God. And it took some time to really strip that down with my relationship with my Heavenly Father and to start to see that, yeah, no matter what I do, he's going to work everything for my good. Because on the opposite side, my addiction wanted to take every situation to make that work for perpetuating an addiction, and type stuff. But then the minute I start to realize that God loves me no matter what, I'm going to go with him. It made it that much easier to recognize that my addiction was just trying to get whatever it wanted, from me type stuff. Definitely makes it a lot easier to present to my God in any circumstance type stuff. And it was a great joy, you know, whether driving to work or, you know, on occasion I ride my bicycle to work to turn off the music and turn off the noise and to just talk out loud with him about anything and whatever circumstance I am. And to know that no matter what I say or do, whether I present humbly to him with all my issues or I present angry and frustrated about certain things in my life, to know that no matter what, he's going to love me, kind of deal was huge. And it's been a huge relief that, you know, now these interpersonal relationships that I have where I'm trying to compete for somebody's, you know, approval or whatever, no longer really hold value, because it's like, I don't need that from somebody else, because I know I can get that from somewhere, you know, from my God. Like, my approval of who I am comes from God, kind of deal. And then mistakes became easier to deal with and recognize that mistakes are a mistake and they're going to serve for learning purposes as opposed to a stumbling block, kind of deal. And I think it's, you know, it's easy for me to say now, but like, if I go back to the kind of where I was at before with trying to understand that God loves and accepts me no matter what, it's really hard until you're at least willing to try and start that process, and start presenting yourself to God and start presenting yourself to others, you know, brothers in group that understand your addiction, and to feel love no matter what. And when I start having relationships with the guys in group and realizing that, hey, they love and appreciate me no matter what. Well, maybe it is true that a God can love and appreciate me and accept me no matter what. And then just step-by-step process to kind of adventure into that and experiment with that and to realize that. But now here, looking back, there's definitely no question that God loves and accepts me no matter what. That the love from him doesn't have to be earned. It's just a matter of me willingly accepting that into my life in every circumstance, kind of deal, is really the struggle. Kind of deal. It was always kind of on my end to be like, yeah, God, you do love me and accept me no matter what. And then accepting that as a realization on a daily basis is still something that has to be, like, I have to do, kind of deal. So.
I love what you're saying there. I'm curious if I was to ask you to try and describe, you know, I'm thinking about, as I'm asking some of these questions, I'm thinking about those guys out there who are in that place pre-recovery, right? Or maybe really early on in the stages. And they may or may not recognize how much that spiritual component plays a role. If you were to kind of get in touch with the darkest version of addict Todd, right?
Yeah.
And not that we want to do it in a bad way.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
But if I was to kind of get you in that headspace for a second, and if you were, if I was to ask that guy to reflect on, you know, what attributes, characteristics, not like what you were taught necessarily, but, you know, if I was to ask you to just describe based on your experience what God was like, who he or she was, how that worked, right? All that stuff. What would you say? And then how would you contrast your relationship with him today?
So if I go back to my darkest time, you know, when I was at my crossroads of either, you know, I'm going to end up in divorce and be at my, on my own and live on my own and deal on my own, you know, kind of deal. And I go back to that, you know, Todd, kind of mindset. It was almost like, I was also trying to eliminate God out of my life. You know, it's like, if I can make him not even be there, right, you know, then I don't have to deal with it. And then at the end of my life, when I'm 16, then I'll deal with it. You know, it'll be a different story. Like, I'll do whatever I want in this situation, in this life. And with these circumstances, like I can deal with whatever, you know, kind of, I'll be on my own, whatever kind of deal. It was the mindset I had. I was like, well, I won't even have to deal with God. You know, I can eliminate him out of my life. On the flip side too, in that darkest hour, you know, that darker time, that mindset was also still, you know, I look back and realize that God, even with that, like, kind of blatant middle finger to, you know, his face kind of deal, was basically what I was doing. Even at that moment, he was still working everything for my good, you know, because it was shortly after that kind of mindset that somehow I got directed towards you guys through people that love me, like through my wife, through my parents, through my in-laws. Because I gave my wife every reason to get rid of me. And I gave every reason for my in-laws to support my wife in that decision. And to some extent, my parents even thought that that was the consequence that I had to have in order for me to understand the extent of my addiction.
Yeah.
But for some odd reason, my in-laws held on to supporting my wife being with me. And then it was like, I got directed by the council after the excommunication to get into a program, and then just one thing after another. And so even with my blatant middle fist to God trying to get rid of him in my worst time, he was still working everything for my good. So it's like, how could I not have a better relationship now in recovery, realizing that even when I was blatantly trying to defy him and get rid of him, he was still trying to be there for me. So, for those guys that are like, well, God can't love me in my addiction, which I think all of us do. Well, I've done this and this. And even I think to some extent they could listen to this and say, oh, well, Todd never did this, right? I'm pretty sure if I knew details, I could relate to it. But, you know, and even, you know, listening to other guys in groups, like, oh, I'm not that bad of an addict kind of deal. I don't care what they've done or, you know, what I've done. God always works everything for your good. And he'll love you and accept you no matter what. And so even in my darkest time, openly trying to find him, he's still working everything. And so realizing that is one of the best things ever. And so those that question it, well, God can't really love me. He's like, well, just try it. Just take one little step. Just take one little, you know, if you're at the point where you're not reaching out to guys, just take one little step and start reaching out to guys and talk about your issues and see if they accept you. And if they accept you, then God can accept you. You know, and it's like, okay, when you start reaching out from there, then start reaching out to God better and talking about those, you know, those things that have been troubling you and have kind of been the fuel for addiction for a while and see where it goes. And then start to realize that God's working everything for your good, no matter what, even in open defiance. So type stuff. So. Anyway,
what are some of the, you know, as you went through this journey, I think all of us, you know, I picture us addicts as kind of like we're that little kid behind the wheel of the car and just kind of driving like, ah, you know, hold hands gripping the wheel, just kind of going crazy, just totally out of control. As you look back, you know, what sorts of, I don't know what the right term would be, warning signals or you know, my car analogy was stop signs did you blow through, where it was like there were things that along the way that said this might not be the right way to go. And then how did you do what we all do, right? Which is just give that stop sign the bird and keep going anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I can honestly look back at any time that I wanted to get caught up in addiction, or any time, you know, prior to any relapse that I had, or even looking at porn or being involved in, an affair, like there was always that little nudge beforehand, right? That little nudge that, you know, in the back of my mind said, hey, this isn't a good idea, kind of deal. And I now realize that that was God in his love, you know, kindly, gently trying to guide me, you know, towards, you know, pulling over that car and stopping and stepping out and taking a breath and realizing where I'm at, kind of deal. And over time, as I start to recognize, hey, there's that little nudge, maybe I should do something different, you know, using that little nudge to be like, okay, well, that's when I should do my reach out, you know, kind of deal. And as I started developing, kind of more, a bigger sensitivity to that little nudge, then the nudges became much more, kind of more watchful, kind of almost like a watchtower kind of nudge, like before the storm was even coming. And then that was like my journey of breaking down all these other things, all these pains and struggles and all these things that were the behaviors that were triggering. And so then little by little, I can kind of back my way with these little nudges away from an addiction. And the same kind of concept, you know, the more I ignore the nudges and dive into, you know, relapse or whatever, the easier it was to ignore the nudges. And so the process going forward was the same process going backward, backwards, the same process going into addiction is the same process coming out of it. And when you go back to age 13, type stuff, would, you know, the process of ignoring those little nudges over time and time, you know, type stuff made it so that, you know, the addiction just kept on going until, you know, it reached a point where, you know, it was, oh, you know, I was caught up in an affair or caught up in a relapse, you know, like I was always discovered no matter what I did, type stuff to try and hide that I was caught up in the behavior, as a result from ignoring the nudges in the first place, type stuff. So, the same way that got me into it is the same way to get out. It was just a matter of flipping that switch and realizing that I can use my own addiction against itself to get into recovery. So,
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like in what ways that happened for you? I think that's interesting.
Yeah. Like I said, when, you know, my open defiance when I got into the group of not wanting to kind of do the work to get into recovery, you know, it was like, okay, if I'll do the bare minimum to just kind of keep Mark and Steve quiet, you know, to pacify them, right? Let's be honest, like week after week, it was like I was the same routine. All, well, Todd, did you do this? Did you do this? Oh, kind of, sort of. And then it's just like, okay, fine, I'll do something just to make them shut up, right? let's be honest, because about it. And so I was like, it's like, okay, well then I'll do a little bit here. And then it was like slowly as I did a little bit, it gave me a little bit of freedom from the addiction, and then a little bit more and a little bit more. And so, and it used to be like when I got in my vehicle, you know, so back, you know, my affairs were usually always at work. I'd get in my vehicle and then that would be my time to kind of separate from being addictive Todd to then now being, you know, the good husband Todd that I needed to be. Kind of deal. And then as I started getting to recovery and doing reach outs, that kind of area in my vehicle now became my sanctuary where I can reach out. So then it became a trigger that, hey, I got into my vehicle. Now I need to reach out, type stuff. Mm-hmm. I have issues. Okay. I'm in my vehicle. I need to reach out. And then as I kept doing that more and more and more, I developed triggers to do good behavior that kind of got me that way. And then over time, I realized that, hey, my behavior was really triggered by internal struggles, by pain. And so if my behavior is always triggered by pain and struggle and all these past issues, now it can serve as a trigger to search out my God and to have a better relationship with him. And if I can seek out a better relationship with him, then by result, I'll have better relationships with myself and with other people, type stuff. And so my triggers toward an addiction, were now my triggers towards, recovery, kind of deal. Those little nudges, you know, that usually triggered, you know, porn relapse now made little nudges to do reach out and connection and recovery work. So.
That's about halfway through the interview that Steve and I had with Todd. So we're going to call that interview with Todd part one. So stay tuned next week where we give you the interview with Todd part two. That's all for today. Thanks for joining us. And remember, the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, it's connection. Together, we can do the impossible.
To learn more about Mark and Steve and to listen to more podcast episodes, visit us at pbscpodcast.com. Everything expressed on the PBSC podcast are the opinions of the hosts and the participants and is for informational and educational purposes only. This podcast should not be considered mental health therapy or as a substitute thereof. It is strongly recommended that you seek out the clinical guidance of an individual qualified mental health professional. If you're experiencing thoughts of suicide, self-harm, or a desire to harm others, please dial 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.